From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. During the 1840s, Americans started heading west. Land was the big draw, of course. It was a trickle of settlers in the early days, slow but steady. And then came 1849, when prospectors found gold in California, and all of a sudden, everything lit up. The historian Will Bagley says gold ignited a frenzy. Tens of thousands raced, in some cases literally raced, west. Bagley's latest volume in his series on the Westward Trails is about the gold rush, and he's joining us today to talk about it. He says this moment in time, this rush for riches, created the American West we all recognize today, the way we develop our communities, our relationship with resources, and maybe most importantly, the way we treated Native people who were already here. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The story of the American settlers moving west in the 1840s and 50s is a big story. In fact, the historian Will Bagley says it's as daunting as trying to eat an elephant telling this story. And he's been picking at this meal for years now, the story of the Oregon and California trails. His latest book in this series is about the gold rush. And Bagley says that's really the heart of this elephant. When gold was discovered in California in 1849, everything changed. Bagley says it was a time that transformed the West, and he says it still defines it today. If you think about the way we develop our communities, the way we exploit natural resources, our political allegiances, our ethnic conflicts, Will Bagley says all of those patterns were set during this time. Today in the program, he's back with us, Will Bagley, to talk about his book. It's called With Golden Visions Bright Before Them. You can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Will Bagley is an independent historian who specializes in Utah and the American West. He is writing a four-volume series called Overland West, which tells the story, as I said, of the Oregon and California trails. This is the second, the book we're talking about, it's second in that series. He's going to be speaking this evening at the Park City Museum, and he's also featured in a Discovery Channel series called Gold Fever. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. Will Bagley, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Always great to be here.
So I want to start with, because you've written about this, the myth that comes along with the story, not just of this particular story, the gold rush, but the idea of the migration west. It's painted, you say in your book, as heroic. You like the idea of complicating it a little bit.
A good historian's job is to complicate what people see as simple.
What's the myth?
The myth is that the heroic pioneers entered a wilderness and brought civilization and Christianity and law, and that they were sterling American people, that they were resisted at every step by vicious Indians, and they consistently tamed the Indians and showed them who was boss. That part's definitely true, but the myth of righteous violence is an endemic part of the legend of the Oregon Trail, the California Trail, and not so much the Mormon Trail, but it was definitely present too. And I see it as an American triumph because what those people achieved with enormous sacrifice was stunning, and many of them were admirable, decent, heroic people. But the consequences of their triumph was an American tragedy, which was the displacement and disenfranchisement and the theft of every acre of land between the Missouri River and the crest of the Sierra Nevada and the Cascades. And it's a great American story.
Yeah. You feel conflicted, I guess, in some way. You have, on one hand, heroic stories stories you said of triumph. On the other hand, it leads to this disaster, environmental disaster in some cases, certainly this ethnic disaster when you're talking about it. So it's a conflicted story for sure.
Well, the subtitle of With Golden Visions Bright Before Them is Trails to the Mining West, 1849 to 1852. And that's a pretty narrow slice of the 30-year period from 1840 to 1870 that the whole massive, too massive series addresses. But the Mining West began the industrialization of the American West. And it was the mineral wealth of the West that essentially made possible and certainly financed the creation of the West we know today. And the consequences of James Marshall's noticing a glint of gold in 1848 in the South Fork of the American River still resonate everywhere you go in the American West. And that industrialization, as we speak, is in hyper mode. And I see a lot of the destruction of our historical heritage, which I value very greatly, to enrich not the public who owns these lands now, but generally foreign speculators, foreign Canadian mining companies. And they have their eyes on several really unique parts of Utah, and they intend to completely destroy them. So this story is an ongoing story of triumph and tragedy. And the question now is who's going to triumph and who's going to pay the cost?
I want to get our bearings here a little bit. In the book, you mention in 1840, the West, it belonged to the Indians, it belonged to Mexico, and it belonged to the Hudson's Bay Company. U.S. had little control of it beyond the Missouri border. And so there's this, but then there begins this kind of slow and steady, I think you say something like 19,000 Americans making their way, 19,000, the first 8 years. But then comes the gold, and then becomes this frenzy. And I want to get a sense of, so at that point, and we'll talk about this as we go, but once gold is discovered, things go crazy, right? I mean, people start heading here in the droves.
It's explosive. You suddenly have instant cities sprout up at Sacramento. San Francisco has about 500 people. It's just changed its name from Yerba Buena. And within a few years, it's a major American metropolis and the major port of trading with the Far East, China, and the wealth of the Indies. Oregon, Portland becomes a substantial city. Before the gold rush is over, people are beginning to move into Carson Valley in western Nevada. And Salt Lake arguably might not have survived without the material support that the gold rushes inadvertently brought to Salt Lake and were too tired to carry to California.
How did it work? You mentioned that for sort of first glint. Was it a eureka moment? How did it play out? The idea of when somebody realized, hey, there's gold.
Well, you could personalize the story and look at a man I've written a biography about or compiled up his papers, Samuel Brannan. And Sam Brannan is one of those great characters of the American West. And I was pleased to see the Discovery Channel has made Brannan and his shenanigans the centerpiece, part of their epic on gold fever. But they haven't hewed strictly to the facts about Brannan, which are it's very hard to do that because Brannan made up a good bit of his own legend. But the facts alone are staggering. And Brannan consciously engineered a gold rush. He was running one of the only two newspapers in California, in San Francisco. And he'd heard rumors about gold. And initially, the California Star thinks it's all poppycock.
Now, this is a Mormon convert.
Well, he's a Mormon convert. He says in his youth he grew up in the house of Joseph Smith in Kirtland, and he did. And you could see many of his tactics are based on his experience in Mormon land speculations and financial shenanigans, but he is the president of the Saints in California by designation from Brigham Young and the Council of 12. And he tries to get Brigham Young in 1847. He comes all the way from California with only three or four other guys to meet, find out what's happened to Brigham Young, because Young was supposed to be in California in 1846. And so Brannan's brought the first shipload of Americans around Cape Horn to settle in California. And they start transforming San Francisco, which H.H. Bancroft says was very largely a Mormon town.
Yeah.
People forget what a major role the Mormons had in founding Sacramento.
But Brannan figures San Francisco is the promised land, right, for Mormons.
California.
Hopes it is. Yeah.
He's seen the Great Basin. Yeah. He comes back and he says, Brigham Young's crazy. They won't last a year there. They'll be over here. But Young knows exactly what he wants. He wants isolation. He wants a refuge. He wants to be in a place nobody else could possibly want.
Right.
And if they go to California, they'll run into their old friends from Missouri, and it'll be all same trouble all over again. But Brannan is sore. And he hears these rumors about gold. He's mentioned it in the interior pages of the California Star, that they say they found a gold mine at Sutter's.
Yeah.
He goes up to investigate, and he finds out that it's real. And he happens to have a store right next to Sutter's Fort. So he goes around and buys up every shovel, every pick, every Indian basket. There weren't a lot of mining pens, but if there were, Brannan bought them. And so he then rushes back to San Francisco, and he lands at the foot of what's Montgomery Street, which is already called Montgomery Street. And he runs up the street on May 10th, 1848. I found the exact date of it in a Mormon journal.
Wow.
And he's yelling, "Gold! Gold! Gold from the American River!" And within a week, there isn't an able-bodied man left in San Francisco. And pretty soon, the ships that are in port, their crews desert. The U.S. Navy loses its crews. The U.S. Army loses its soldiers. And everybody is up in the gold field picking up gold. It's an extraordinary moment. And on that same night that Brannan announces the find, he calls a meeting of the Mormons. And he announces that he's done. He's through. He's not going to be president of the Mormons anymore. And he advises them, you guys get your fannies up there and get rich. And that's factually what I was able to determine from the documents happened. But it is a great story.
Yeah.
And it begins, what I argue in the book, is the belief that I think we all hold as Americans, that we are born with the right to get rich quick.
You say this was the beginning of that notion. It wasn't a faith, you said, that we held as a people before this.
No. People believed that the way to get rich was to work really hard for a long, long time. And there were exceptions in land speculation or going out west and killing enough beaver to make a killing. But there was no other way to accumulate wealth rapidly. And the gold rush makes that entirely possible. And the letters people write home, the newspapers, are filled with stories of men digging up in a day what would take a year to make in the States. And they're true. They're exaggerated oftentimes, but many of these stories are true. And it begins changing the American psyche. There had been minor gold rushes in Georgia and elsewhere, but this was the big one. And this creates begins the major transformation of the entire West.
You say the news of the discovery of gold came at a critical moment. You talk about how before 1848, 1849, you had a bunch of pioneering families who made their way west. But gold fever, you say, brought a new group, a flood of men. You describe them as fortune hunters and freebooters. And you say there were some good men there. But you also say a lot of them, and most of them, had been depicted ruthless, cowardly, violent, merciless, reckless, deranged, and dirty scoundrels.
Well, that was certainly a large contingent of the 49ers. And in fact, the heroic image of the pioneers before the gold rush is contradicted very often by
the reality.
The people who were already here. The Hudson Bay Company, some of its officers called the pioneers of the 1840s the scum and refuse of the back states. And until 1849, not a lot of really stable, intelligent people made that trek, because you had to have no idea of what was coming. It was such a hard ordeal.
Nothing to lose.
And it was the people who had been moving west since the Mayflower. Mm. And you see families that are always taking the next chance. And they very seldom do they wind up any better off than they were in the States. And they passed up all this great fertile land in the American Midwest where they could have had very stable lives. But the West draws risk takers. And the gold rush draws a tremendous number of doctors, lawyers, the surplus of professional men who are displaced by the slow economy of the United States. After the panic of 1837, even the Mexican War didn't really pull the United States out of an economic stagnation. And my thesis is that the gold rush provides capital. Before 1849, American capital came from Britain.
Yeah.
And it was completely controlled by foreign sources. But something – and I know economic historians who don't agree with this thesis. They say, well, the impact of that gold was very minor. I don't think so. What financed the creation of California or San Francisco and Sacramento? It had major economic impacts. And the people, the goal of virtually every 49er was not to go out to the paradise of California and settle. It was to go in.
Get your money and get out.
Yeah, exactly. And get back to the States, buy a farm, buy a factory, buy a way that you could be rich the rest of your life.
Right.
And that really begins propelling American industry. If you look at the industrialization of America, there's a tremendous surge during the early 1850s. Railroad building, manufacturing, the whole economy booms every 20 years until the Great Depression, you have a panic, which is basically a depression.
Yeah.
And that worked about every 20 years. You can predict that the whole economy is going to crash and burn because bankers are greedy, speculate, and the banks all collapse. Well, that didn't happen for 80 years after the Great Depression because there was this law called the Glass-Steagall Law, and it regulated bankers. It said speculating banking, investment banking, you can't do that and get government guarantees. And so we went a remarkable length of time without a crash. But then they repeal it, and Bill Clinton's as culpable as anybody else in this, and the economy crashes in 2008. And we're still getting ready for the next bubble to appear.
That's right.
Away we go.
You said something about the people of the West, how it draws risk takers. Mm. So the thing that came to my mind, so do the remnants of that sort of people remain here today? You know, are we as Western people
absolutely
genetically sort of a different sort?
Yes. Well, one of the great theses of American history is the Turner thesis, that the frontier fundamentally altered and affected Western character, American character. And it's been widely challenged by my generation of historians. And I've never sat down and I had somebody, a grad student once asked me, are you a Turnerian? And I go, I don't know. I've never devoted a lot of thought to it. But Turner's influence is undeniable, and he was a good writer and historian. And I still believe there, it may not be as absolute, and I don't believe in American exceptionalism. I think every country has its own situations and events, and America's are certainly a useful study of American or human character. But we're all humans, and I don't think America's story is you can find many comparisons between the American frontier and the Russian frontier or the Australian frontier or South America. And America has a national character. You can see this when you go abroad, and the Germans have a national character, the French have one, the British have one, and Americans definitely have one. And I believe it comes from history. And the role of the frontier in American history is tremendous. And in the West, it helps create us Westerners.
Will Bagley is with us. His latest book is called With Golden Visions Bright Before Them, Trails to the Mining West, 1849 to 1852. This evening at 5:30, he's speaking at the Park City Museum on Main Street there. The lecture is about the role of the Army and the U.S. mail in westward expansion. We also should mention, as we said before, there's a Discovery Channel series called Gold Fever, and Will is prominently featured in that. Parts 3 and 4 are going to be airing tomorrow night, so check your local listings for that. Or just go to our website for details, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Will Bagley is with us. He's been writing about the settlers who made their way west along the Oregon and California trails, and his latest volume of that story is about the Gold Rush, which began in 1848, 1849. People, of course, were headed this way before all of that, but Will Bagley says the prospect of quick riches ignited a frenzy. Along the way, he says, all of this created what we now know as the American West. His book is called With Golden Visions Bright Before Them, Trails to the Mining West, 1849 to 1852. And Will Bagley is joining us here in the studio. We'll give you details about it. He's got an event this evening at the Park City Museum, and we'll tell you about that a little bit later. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Rick, who's in Orem, Utah. Rick, hi.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question about the involvement or influence of soldiers mustered out from the Mormon Battalion on the Discovery and the subsequent Gold Rush. I understand that my great-great-grandfather, Robert Owens, who was in the Mormon Battalion when they mustered out in San Diego, had traveled up and was at Sutter's Mill, I guess with several other people working at Sutter's Mill when gold was discovered. And he eventually came back to Utah, lived here for a while, but decided he liked California and returned and lived out his life there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely the broad outlines of a true story. And we have it's one of the discovery of gold is one of those incidents that we can look at in microscopic detail. Owens was not at Sutter's Mill. He may have been at the sawmill that was being built at the same time. Or no, the flour mill at Natona. But the gold was found at James Marshall. It was Marshall and Sutter in a cooperative effort. They'd hired a bunch of Mormon Battalion veterans. And I've got a thesis, which is there's good evidence that the Mormons had actually found the gold in late 1847 and had kept it a secret from everybody and were collecting it while they were supposed to be digging the ditch for the mill. But it's too arcane a subject and challenges too many conventions. And so...
Well, that's never stopped you before, has it?
Not really. Maybe I will get around to it. But so the Mormons are remarkable. They have a major role in California in the discovery of gold. And since there are about 230 Mormons who sailed out with Brannan, and there are another 330 who come to California with Lieutenant Colonel Cook, there aren't many white people in California. And they're there at the moment of the discovery when gold is everywhere. Yeah. They're for the picking up. And they pick it up. They collect a great deal of gold. And then right in the middle of 1848, which is the very best time to mine for gold in California, pick up placer mining gold, they pack up in three or four parties. They buy wagons and they pack up. They buy supplies, seeds and saplings and horses and animals. They take the guys who were at Sutter's Mill take their pay in goods from Sutter, including a cannon. And they haul that. They open up the Carson River, the Carson Pass Trail, which is now known as the Mormon Carson Immigrant Trail, and they go to Utah. They've never been to Utah. They've never seen it, but they've been told to come back, and a surprising number of them do immediately. Hmm. And like Owen, many of them, after getting a look at Utah, decide California is a better place to be, and wind up out there. But the most of the gold seekers wind up getting into California in 1849 over the Mormon Carson Immigrant Trail. So it's a big, big role. And the Mormon Battalion, I've written many books on the Mormon Battalion. I've written books about the opening of that pass. And so I know it pretty well.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Rick, for the call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join us. So I love the part of the book where you write about what the trail was like. Because you write about the particulars of the experience. And the wagons themselves, I want you to talk about that. Because I had no idea they had funny names and interesting figures painted on them, and they could be colorful, some of these wagons.
Well, one of the advantages of having this massive, in fact, too massive in many ways, project is I can set out at what my friend John McFarriger at Yale called a leisurely pace. And I'm able to try to convey what life was like on the trail, the details of how they did it and what the experience was like. And I'll read one paragraph. The wagons assembling along the river were almost as colorful as their owners. Charles T. Harker left Independence in a, quote, large, dashing red wagon covered with India rubber cloth drawn by four fiery mules. Kickapoos, wrapped in colorful blankets but otherwise almost naked, greeted Wilhelm Hoffman as he rolled west from St. Joseph in a blue wagon with red wheels and a yellow top. Alonzo Delano described the quaint names and devices on some of the wagons. The Lone Star would be seen rising over a hill, the Live Hoosier rolling along with the Wild Yankee, the Rough and Ready, the Enterprise, the Dowdle family. We're moving with slow and steady pace, with a right smart sprinkle of elephants, buffaloes, and gold hunters painted on the canvas of the wagons, together with many other quite amusing devices. William Lorton saw one wagon labeled Traveling Edition of Pilgrim's Progress, and wagon tops painted with elephants and buffaloes on their way to California in caricature. and part of the joy of doing this project is the eloquence of writers in the 1850s. They're great. They use these amazing similes and metaphors, and they know their literature. And I'm essentially a plagiarist. I'm looting all these phenomenal American narratives.
It brings us to a story. You mentioned the sort of articulate sort of literary sensibilities of some of these guys. Talk about Dr. J.R. Bradway, because there's a really terrific letter that he writes to another doctor, a Henderson Hunt. This is in July of 1853, about he encountered, I'll just sort of set you up here, he encountered this trading post, which he described as being kept by a woman dressed in men's clothing and generally known and distinguished as Captain Jane. Being a very novel character, I must give her rather more than a passing notice. And he writes a really great description of her.
He goes on for pages about her. It's a good example of how middle-class Americans find their world values, their Christian Victorian principles, completely tossed up in the air in the American West. And they meet individual characters. They meet other nationalities. They meet Indians. Some of them turn out to be educated and very intelligent, and the stereotypes just crumble.
Yeah.
But this woman, Captain Jane, is an American woman from Chicago. She brought her own wagon train out in 1850, which she owned. She's taken up stock raising and trading and anything that'll make money. And in 1853, she's taken a wagon all the way to what is now the Rye Patch Reservoir on the Black Rock Desert in Nevada. It's about 50 miles south of Winnemucca. I mean, this is the middle of nowhere, literally.
Yeah.
And she's making money.
Yep.
She's cutting deals. She's smoking cigars and drinking whiskey, but she doesn't swear. And he says, if you heard her voice without seeing her, you would assume she was a young woman, but she looks like a somewhat feminine young man. And he says, as I look closer, he says, I thought at first she could be a beardless youth of 25, but as I look closer, I could see the wrinkles in her face. And he says, she's apparently about 40, neither young nor old. And he, because she has clearly assumed a man's role and is dressed as a man, doing man's work, it makes him look at the whole standard assignments. When he mentions that society has a place for each of us to fit, and he argues that, well, maybe we should have a third masculo-feminine gender. Those are his words.
Can I read a section?
Yes, absolutely.
You mentioned the sort of literary tastes, and he references Shakespeare in this thing. Mm-hmm. He says, Shakespeare says, nature hath made some strange fellows, and it is just as true that she hath made some strange women, some with such manly aspirations and such constant inclination to engage in the business of men that you would almost that either nature or somebody else has placed them in the wrong sphere.
Or society. And he does. He concludes that, well, shouldn't these people have the same rights as anybody else?
Yeah.
Which is you wouldn't think you would find an eloquent, detailed defense of gay marriage at a trading post in the Black Rock Desert in 1853. But Dr. Bradway provides it for you. And it's this kind of surprise and encountering these people who are reacting to these experiences that are completely new and different to them that makes my work such a joy.
I want to ask you about you write about the roles of men and women on the trail, about the violence there, about, you know, bison and bird hunting. We'll get to some of this, but I wanted to talk about these July 4th celebrations that you write about in 1849. And they sound kind of frightening, kind of disturbing, pretty rowdy. And if you were a Native American, they scared the hell out of you, these things.
Well, you knew that these people were crazy. But what they do on a midsummer day, the Indians don't have a clue about why all of a sudden at dawn people will get up and shoot off a joie de fête, which is they'll stand up and start firing a serial volley. Everybody will fire in sequence. And they blow up the gunpowder. They have these immense feasts. And what they were duplicating are the celebrations they've known back home.
Yeah.
And many of them have saved alcohol or a cake for this special event. And if you look at the menus, they record the menus that are offered at these elaborate dinners, as they call them. And they're just extraordinary. They'll have 5 different kinds of pies and 6 different kinds of cakes. Oysters. Oysters are real big. There's one guy who opens a tin of lobster on the Black Rock Desert. Just amazing. And the role of alcohol in all these events is also quite interesting. There are a lot of parties that swear they won't drink when they're on the trail, but they've all got medicinal whiskey, and it tends to get used up by the 4th of July.
Will Bagley is with us. His latest book is called With Golden Visions Bright Before Them, Trails to the Mining West, 1849 to 1852. He's going to be at the Park City Museum on Main Street this evening at 5:30. It's a lecture. And we should also mention he's featured in the Discovery Channel series called Gold Fever, Parts 3 and 4 air tomorrow night. You can find all of the details of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. More stories to come when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West at KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the historian Will Bagley. We're talking about his book, With Golden Visions Bright Before Them. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. There are a lot of great characters, of course, in these stories. A lot of great women characters. Captain Jane is one we talked about. Let's talk about Mary Brush. Because the sense that you get in the stories of Mary Brush, she's this 25-year-old woman, has a young daughter, has a husband, and you tell this story about this last night of August, I think it's 1849, yep. Is it? And which kind of gives you a sense, there are a couple of stories in here about kind of what it was really like. Talk a little bit about her, if you would.
I discovered a letter that had appeared in fall of 1849, written from California, detailing her experiences. And she seems to, 49ers were always looking for a shortcut. They wanted to get there quick, and the shortcuts that were marketed at the time, the Hastings Cutoff and the Lassen Cutoff, were longer and harder and much worse than just sticking with the main track. And Mary Brush may be one of only 2 people I could identify who wound up seemed to have taken both routes.
Wow.
And she, the Lassen Cutoff provided a safety valve because it's only becomes widely used in late August. And by that time, everything between Black Rock Desert, where it started, and the Sierra Nevada had been stripped clean.
And of grass.
Almost as many people go over the Lassen Cutoff as go over Carson Pass. And in fact, it's about 250 miles longer than the standard route. But Mary personified to me the heroism and the sacrifices and the suffering that these incredible women experienced. This is what I say about Mary. Mary wrote home that it was on Lassen's track, which was about 500 miles further and over such roads as none but a California has ever seen, that her real troubles commenced. Trapped in the snow and rain with her daughter Emily while her husband went for help, Brush survived for a week without a dry thread on me, and everything in the wagon was thoroughly soaked, she wrote. I could have wrung the bedclothes. On a bitterly cold night of 3 November 1849, she made supper and went to bed with Emily. Brush got up three times to wring the water from her hair and found a yoke of oxen chilled to death in the morning. "Dear friends, is it not hard to get to California?" she asked. "Do not let anyone come if you can hinder it, particularly overland." It was estimated that not one-tenth of the animals that leave the States live to get through, but as she learned, if necessity says so, people do with very little.
Trying to imagine someone in the middle of a November, you know, in the middle of night.
With a child to protect, with Indians. And the Indians on the Lassen Cutoff were the hardest Indians the immigrants encountered.
Well, you tell another story, which in August when everyone in camp, all the men in camp, go out to try to sort of protect everybody else, and they're terrified in the middle of the night.
It's amazing how fearful people are of Indians. And in fact, the Indians were absolutely baffled by the immigrants. And it's only Indians who've had a lot of experience with white folks that are really a threat to them, because on the Plains Indians like to trade. They help people cross rivers. There was no real violence experienced by 49ers and 1850 people from the tribes, many of whom had fled the trail because of cholera, which had killed entire bands of Indians. But once you got into the Great Basin, where resources are so tight, the Indians were going to wait until it got – they've never attacked in broad daylight. They waited until it was dark, and they went in and they shot the oxen and mules full of – they preferred the oxen full of arrows, and then the oxen would die and the immigrants would have to leave it behind, and they'd pick up the result. But this is James Evans' account of what happened to him on the 40-mile desert. And the thing about the California Trail, the Mormon Trail was difficult, let's say. But it stopped before the trail west really got hard.
Yeah.
And the trail up the Snake River to Oregon and the trail across the Great Basin was it got worse and worse and worse. You can see this if you drive to Reno. You know, you start out at the top of the Humboldt in Ruby Valley. It's beautiful. You get to the 40-mile desert, which is the last of the Humboldt. Humboldt disappears into the sands. It's an incredibly stark, alien landscape, something these people had never imagined. And the last ordeal was 40 miles of bad sand road to get either to the Truckee River or the Carson River. And it's lined with wrecked wagons and dead animals. And James Evans sets out in August. Evans felt fate, but rode on resolved to get as far as I could. As he pressed on across the desert's last sandy miles, Evans met a friendly Indian, those poor savages who had, during the trip, shot arrows at us at night and had killed several immigrants, including a guard Evans had watched die. Even they were moved with sympathy. Here came the Indian, nearly naked, walking barefooted on the hot sand, with a bucket, a little tin bucket, of water for the famishing immigrants. The man, probably a northern Paiute, offered Evans the pail, exclaiming, "Waddy! Waddy! Oh, white man! Waddy!" I could not help shedding a tear, but refused to drink, telling him that there were men behind who were famishing for water worse than me to carry it to them. The Paiute held up four fingers to show Evans how many miles until he reached water, and to show it was plenty, he walked as if he were wading, and then showed me how deep it came on his legs. The benevolent Samaritan found the famished man, gave him two or three drinks of water, brought up an Indian pony, put the white man on him, and took him on until he came to Truckee River. Oh, such generosity, Evans explained. Pray, why do not these immigrants who are ahead have the same feelings of humanity? It's an extraordinary incident.
Yeah.
And it's to me, what's important about these stories is that they're human stories. They're about what human beings do and what human beings can endure and how noble humans can be and how depraved.
You write about how before Indians came in contact with Europeans, there were somewhere in the order of 310,000 Indians in California. By 1860, just more than 17,500.
One of the impacts of the discovery of America that historians don't often factor into this enormous conflict which takes place between Christian civilization and the native cultures is the impact of disease and how demoralizing it would be to see three-quarters of the people you knew, nine-tenths of the people you knew, suddenly take sick and die for no known reason. Your entire worldview, your thoughts about why the cosmos did things like this would be completely overturned, and you would have to take a new approach. So by the time the gold rush starts, American Indian cultures had been experiencing these devastating events. And the survivors were resilient, tough people. But with the advent of gold in California, what happens in California is genocide. I've worked through arguments saying that it wasn't really genocide because it wasn't official government policy. Well, in California, it was official policy. It may not have been enunciated, but that's what they did. And the consequences were devastating. But at the same time, I don't see the Indians as helpless victims. They are part of one force that encounters another force, and every encounter between a technologically sophisticated society and a technologically unsophisticated society ends the same. The native peoples encountering an industrial civilization always lose, always. And they fight back. They know what's at stake. They're very much aware of the contest. And the book functionally ends. There's a summary chapter at the end, but the ending event is an analysis of what's called the Bloody Point Massacre, which was mostly imagined. But the Modocs, who were one of the most colorful and interesting tribes in the American West, definitely were fighting back. And this is how I summarize that part of it. For the next two decades after 1853, the blazing of every new road, cutoff, and trail ignited a new Indian war. The tide of humanity flowing through native lands ran faster every year, and the people who had long made overland travel possible, the Indians, learned that the white people had not come to visit but to stay. When they did, they would do as they had done in Oregon and Utah and California, and make the grass, game, water, and even the rocks their own. Native people had to do something. Shoshone-Shin, the Modoc leader later credited with leading the raids at Bloody Point, told an Indian agent, "I thought if we killed all the white men we saw, that no more would come. We killed all we could, but they came more and more like new grass in the spring."
Something else you write at the end, Will Bagley, that you say this notion that anyone ever learns anything from history is dubious, but you say it doesn't prevent the past from lighting the way to a more just or tolerant or sustainable future.
I hope.
What do you mean? Such a hopeful ending in some way. You think that, all right, so we had some really dreadful moments of the past, but that and we don't often learn from that, but you hope that there will be some light there, I guess.
That's certainly the hope. And I feel like I've learned a lot from history. But I was writing this part, I've spent 14 years almost working on this project. And in the middle of it, we become entangled in Iraq. And we repeat Vietnam. And I thought, here's a president who's a quote-unquote veteran of the Vietnam era, and he decides he's going to get us back waist-deep in the big muddy in a different location and fight in the desert instead of fighting in the jungle. And that really was a persuasive argument that people do not learn from history. But there are lessons to be learned. And I think that it's important to tell history as best we can to how it happened. And the lessons are often ambiguous. They're not black and white. History is complicated.
Will Bagley. His book is called With Golden Visions Bright Before Them, Trails to the Mining West, 1849 to 1852. He's going to be in Park City at the Park City Museum there on Main Street this evening. That's at 5:30. He's also going to be, well, he's featured in this Discovery Channel series. It's called Gold Fever. You can see parts 2 and 3 tomorrow night, and you can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Will, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
A reminder of our companion site, Video West. This week, we're featuring a new short film by The Good Line. It's a portrait of a savant sculptor, Alonzo Clemens. You can watch it at videowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. The show directed today by Michael Havey. Produced, as always, by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.